Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. One thing that has been occurring to me recently is how difficult it is to talk about ordinary daily life training. It's easier for me anyway to focus on meditation, partly because meditation has been the center of my life for most of my life now, about two-thirds of my life. And partly because when I do these recorded talks, I know that some people might be listening to the talks who have just started a practice of meditation, perhaps have never had a chance to visit a temple or monastery, and don't really have the training context that can only come from spending the time in a community of people training together. So you might say, with that at the back of my mind, I think sometimes I kind of cut my losses and just focus on meditation, hoping I'll say something that'll be helpful to a wide range of people. But I want to say now something that I don't remember saying, and that is how very, very important it is for everyone who's going to do this training to go train in a community for a while. A community that's led by a qualified teacher. And to have the benefit of just joining in the activities of the community and training in a way that, learning in a way that is very, very difficult to learn in any other context. You're joining in the shared activities, the work, the social activities, the meals. Now at this point I'd like to say something that doesn't come from Buddhism but comes from a little bit of knowledge of human history and having lived a little bit in more traditional cultures. In the Western world today, and in some other places as well, young people have a wide choice, many young people, not necessarily all, but many people have a wide choice of potential occupations. You know, in traditional societies, which means virtually everything up until the last century or so, and even everything up to the last half century or so, really, the great majority of people had very little choice along those lines. They did what their parents did. Things were laid out for them. If you were the son of a farmer, you farmed. If you were the son of a cobbler, you became a cobbler, and so on. There were some societies where this was actually a law for at least some classes of people. There's some societies today, very populous societies, where this is still a strong element. The caste system in India, for example. For those who still subscribe to that, you know, you stay in your caste. For the purposes of my talk today, this means something significant. That you did not, for most people until very recently in human history, you did not have to make a decision about the kind of service you were going to perform, the kind of offering you were going to make. The place where you had a choice was in the attitude with which you went about making that offering. Nowadays, many people spend much of their life dithering over the kind of offering they're going to make, more or less stupefied by the amount of choice that's out there. And because there is so much choice, even people who made a commitment to one particular career, say, still in their ordinary daily lives, they have a great deal of leisure time. And therefore, that choice is there again. So what am I going to do with the time? Well, as I've more or less been pointing out, there's what one is going to do with the time, and there's the attitude with which one is going to do it. Training in Buddhism, Zen training in particular, Zen training more than any other form of training, and Soto Zen more than any other form of Zen, helps you especially with that issue of the attitude, choosing the attitude with which you're going to do what you're going to do. Any effort at all to bring meditation into the picture in any activity changes that activity, the way we're doing it, and what it means to us. I'll repeat that. It changes the way we do it, and it changes what it means to us. Those are equally important. Usually we have to do those two in that order. First, we have to have the faith to change the way we go about it, do things more meditatively. And then we find that the meaning is changing for us. But bear in mind that that is a simplification because the two are actually always going hand in hand. Just because as soon as you bring meditation into something, the role of self begins to diminish. And when the role of self begins to diminish, what it reveals is the potential selfless meaning of what one is doing, or to put it another way, an unselfish meaning, or a less selfish meaning to what one is doing. put it more accurately, a less egocentric or self-centered meaning. And this is really one of the wonderful things about training in a community. And it's, I think, one of the reasons why I forget to talk about this subject I'm talking about today as much as I should, because after all, I have lived in a monastic community almost my whole, well, two-thirds of my life. And so I kind of take it for granted that that is a context. People are hearing me with. But of course, for many people, that's really not the context. So if I talk about meditation, if I talk about aspects of deeper spirituality, which I often do, talking about the reharmonizing with the eternal, talking about cleansing and conversion of karma, talking about the following of the spirit of the precepts. All of that assumes a certain way of going about your life. That I learned not by studying these things intellectually, but by living in a monastic community and training as a disciple of my master within that context. And in that context, you have innumerable opportunities for service, and especially when you are beginning your training, you're like those people I talked about who had no choice about what they were going to do. When you're a novice monk, you don't go out in the morning, you'll stretch and yawn and say, oh, it's a nice day, I think I'll do X, Y, or Z. You go to your job that's an assigned job. And you work under the guidance and under the eye of someone senior to you. And if you don't do it right, both in what you're doing, the what of it, and the attitude of it, you get corrected. If you're someone who really wants to make an offering, it's a wonderful situation to live in because there's limitless offerings to make. If you're someone who insists that you have to decide all the time which offering you're going to make and which you're not going to make, it's not a good situation because you're not allowed to pick and choose. When you become a senior monk, it's assumed that you're getting beyond the point where you're insisting on you picking and choosing. And you're someone who's listening to their heart. So that it's assumed that you're someone who's still living and very committed to living in an unselfish way. In my talk yesterday, I used the metaphor of the boat out in the middle of the lake in a dense fog, which really you could say is the state of unknowing, which if we only but knew it is really our default state spiritually, a state of unknowing. And I talked about fact that you're never going to get to the other shore unless you row. Well, the practice of generosity or charity, which doesn't mean in the context of which I'm speaking now, it does not mean giving money or objects to others, but means meditative and unselfish service. That's absolutely essential part of the rowing. And it's certainly as important a part of Soto Zen practice as any other part. People think that just by meditating a lot, they can convert karma. They have an enormously simplistic and fatally one-sided view of what they're trying to do. This has got to be a 24-hour-a-day business. And both the difficulty and the joy of it is that everything that one does that is preceptual, that is in accordance and in harmony with the precepts, becomes and is a precious opportunity to both move in the direction of enlightenment and to express what is called original enlightenment. You can't wait till the lightning bolt hits you one day and you're enlightened. You got to act like someone who is enlightened. And that's what makes possible enlightenment. This, of course, is a case of hoisting oneself up by one's own shoelaces. But in this case, the shoelaces are the Buddha nature itself. And the first premise of Buddhism, really of all religion, is that everyone possesses the Buddha nature. So what we aspire to in our daily activity is nothing less than doing the work and the activity of a Buddha. When we do the work and the activity of a Buddha with the mind of a Buddha, well, what do you have? The manifestation of a Buddha. Doing our spring retreat now. And of course, this is a really great opportunity to just focus in on both the meditation and the meditative activity and offering. Don't think of one as more important than the other, or more real, or more spiritual. Stillness and the activity are like the two hands in the gassho. You need them both. They're two complementary aspects of one spiritual life and reality. There's a rhythm of our activity. We meditate, we work, we eat, we rest, we meditate, work, eat, rest. Go on a walk, look after the animals, care for the garden, cook food. Etc., etc. Just doing the things that need to be done doesn't seem like any great thing. But boy, are appearances misleading in that respect.